Can I have your attention just for one moment, please? My notes say I'm supposed to say good morning, but we're running 7 minutes behind, so good afternoon. Still good morning. Welcome, everyone. My name is Chris Marshall. I'm the Associate Vice President for Alumni Affairs. We are so excited you're all here. It is my job. Yeah, this is exciting. Please keep eating. We're going to work right through the program. And in about 20 or 25 minutes or so, we'll have Sam come up and begin his talk. But just a couple quick things. We have, as of last night, the number I had was 818 alumni joining us here in D.C. We had a busy morning of board meetings, committee meetings, lots of other work going on. And I think a great way to kick off the weekend is to have a phenomenal talk from one of our star, our rock star faculty, as we call them. Sam Bachrat will be here in about 20 minutes to talk you through his speech. A couple of questions to think about over the course of your meal. Just ponder this before Sam goes. How many people think their boss does a great job with leadership? I do, because he's sitting right there. And Charlie had to raise his hand because his boss is watching somewhere. David's ever present. How many people do they think they do a great job with leadership? Interesting question to think about. How many people could do a better job with the people they manage? I know my staff want to see my hand go up, that's for sure. So one of the great things about our conference is whether you consider these questions from a professional point of view or from your role as a volunteer, what we're doing this weekend is all about those kinds of questions. It's going to help you both with your professional life, your personal life, and your role as a volunteer. So after lunch, Professor Sam Bachrat will be joining us to talk about this and more. You got about 20 minutes to eat up quick. Our wait staff is ready to plate your lunch course. And Sam will be up. We'll have a special introduction from one of his former students. And then I'll come up at the end to wrap things up. So please go ahead and enjoy your meal, and thanks for being here.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Paul Salvatore. It's a pleasure to see so many committed, passionate Cornellians at our inaugural Alumni Leadership Conference. We're over 800 strong this weekend. That's over 800 current and future alumni leaders of our noble alma mater. Since our theme this weekend is leadership, it's only fitting that our luncheon speaker, Professor Sam Bachrat, is one of the foremost scholars, thinkers, and speakers in the field of leadership. Sam is the McKelvey Grant Professor in the ILR School and has been on the Cornell faculty since 1975. He is a member of the Department of Organizational Behavior and on several occasions has been chair of that department. Throughout his career, he has been a central figure in the ILR School. Sam's prolific academic career includes over 150 academic articles, 15 books, and numerous research grants totaling in the millions of dollars. His academic work has been in the areas of negotiation, leadership, organizational change, organizational politics, and employee engagement. Throughout his career, Sam has been highly committed to undergraduate education at Cornell, having advised many students who have become leaders in business, unions, and government. In many ways, Sam has not only been an extremely active academic researcher and teacher, but as some of you may have seen in the recent issue of Ezra magazine, he's been an academic entrepreneur. Committed to both Cornell and New York City, Sam has established a thriving master's degree program for adult students taught by Ithaca-based faculty in New York City. Additionally, he has started the Institute for Workplace Studies in New York City, which, among other things, provides courses to ILR students who are serving in internships in businesses, law firms, and unions in and government in the city. He also founded the Smithers Institute, which researches on alcoholism issues in the workplace. Now, Sam recently took a little bit of a detour, a change in his career, and found what we could refer to as a second voice or a popular voice when he turned his academic work into two best-selling leadership books, Get Them on Your Side and Keep Them on Your Side. And I believe he's going to be having a book signing this weekend for those that are interested in getting those excellent books, which really, as you'll hear, boil down leadership into a learnable skill. Sam has been at the forefront of the university's entrepreneurial activity in eCornell. An early devotee among the faculty, he's taken the lead in converting many of his courses into leadership online courses that are used by Fortune 500 companies and others. While somewhat sadly, Sam is not a Cornell alum, perhaps his only small deficit, I can attest from my personal experience that it's hard to find a loyaler Cornellian than Sam Bacharach. He's constantly networking with alumni, both in New York City and throughout the world, connecting them or reconnecting them to Cornell. Sam is passionate about the ILR School. He's passionate about our great university, just like all of we are. I know that Sam is very proud to have the opportunity today to share his insights on leadership with this outstanding group of Cornell leaders. So let's give Sam a big red welcome. My good friend, Sam Bacharach.
He does nothing. The reason I'm not a Cornell alum is when I graduated from Jamaica High School, I got turned down. So actually, I've come back as a chair professor for revenge. I mean, I'm asked today to talk about leadership, and I'm asked to be brief. I'm asked to be to get to the point, and I'm asked to keep it to a few PowerPoints as possible. So I've ignored all that advice, and I'll do what I try to do best. First of all, I wanted to say something about Cornell, and you all come in here as alum. I think one of the things that we often forget, that people like myself, people like my colleague Nick Salvatore sitting over there, we also grew up at Cornell. We came to Cornell in our 20s or early 30s. I came to Cornell, I was 26, 27 years old. Cornell to me is much a place, as much a home as any place. I grew up there. I came there and they looked at me with my hair from the University of Wisconsin, and I didn't think I would be here talking to you today. I thought I'd be out of there after 4 years. Cornell is where a lot of the faculty, as much as you, also grow up. So it's very much part of our community. When I see something like this, not only am I flattered to be in front of you, but I got to tell you the truth, it's a little touching. So given that, I didn't practice this. What do you all share with me? They put you in a room, as they put me in a room, and they tell us to lead. What don't we have? You know, I have a 14-year-old, built a house in the country. Figured he's going to love this place. I can't get him to come up to the country. So what do I have in common with Barack Obama and Dave Scorton? None of us can get people to do exactly what we want them to do. None of us really have as much leverage as we'd like to have. You know, leadership ought to be reduced and washed, so the L is reduced to a little L, not a big L. We really have a lot less leverage. But in a workplace, you can't get your assistant, your colleagues, you can't get them to do as much as you want them to do. So the question is, how do you lead without leverage? And if you could figure that out this week, let me know, but I'll try to help. How can you lead without leverage? But before I get to that, last night I had a nice talk with my good friend Nick, who you've been listening to later, and I thought about something. Why should you listen to a Cornell professor talk about leadership? I mean, most of you think we're up there in Ithaca doing irrelevant stuff anyway. Why should you listen to us? I'll tell you why. Because the Cornell pedagogy is about talking two ways. Yes, on the one hand, it's about talking about facts and data and theory. But on the other hand, it's getting our students to think in a particular way. It's making sure that our students leave Cornell not remembering what they learned on page 37, but remembering how to think about what they learned. So what we try to do in the Iowa Law School, for example, is to make sure our students think in a particular way. So today, I don't want to talk in leadership in the detail. I want to present to you a model of leadership that maybe will get you to think in a particular way about leadership. Am I going to say something new? If you find that I said something new in the next 25, 30 minutes, Charlie Flager is going here with the watch. If I say something new in the next 25, 30 minutes, there's something wrong with somebody here and it's not me. Because I don't think I'm going to be saying something that particularly new. And when I speak to my students, they don't really go, aha. I just give them order. What I want to do today is give a little order to the leadership notions. So, my concern for the last number of years has been about the pragmatic micro skills of leaders. I want to know what it is that leaders do. Now, when you go to Barnes & Noble, I live on 17th Street in Manhattan, and every so often I'll go up to Union Square and I'll check the leadership section. I think every night they get like a truck that comes in and dumps 500 leadership books in there. All right. And all the time I'm told I have to have a brilliant idea, I need to be irresistible charisma, and of course I have to have some prophetic vision in order to lead. Now, clearly most of us have some of this, but we don't share it. Who has this? So when we ask my students at Cornell, name me leaders, here's the top four. Here's the top four. Martin Luther King, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Abraham Lincoln, and they always throw in Mother Teresa. Which also says something about gender biases in leadership, which I won't get into right now. This whole model is based about some notion of charisma. Why? So I ask people, why Martin Luther King? Recently I had a chance to speak to a minority caucus in one of my major unions, and I asked someone, why Martin Luther King? He had a new vision, he said to me. When I turned around, I took a deep breath, and I said, no, he didn't. He executed on the same vision your grandfather had. Martin Luther King's vision was there, but Martin Luther King's skills were as an execution. If you read what I consider to be, and the historians here may disagree with me, the best book I've read on leadership, which is Doris Kearns Goodwin's A Team of Rivals, which I recommend over any management book you want to read. If you read that, you read of a man that knew how to execute. You read of a man that understood, when should I release the Emancipation Proclamation, another book big enough to be inconsistent by Fredrickson. A man that thought about these issues. So for me, leadership is about the capacity to execute. It's about the capacity to get things done. Leadership is about getting things done. Now, if you begin to talk to leaders, et cetera, there are four things all of them understand. And you know, giving this talk against the backdrop of the State of the Union, I kept on thinking, should I refer to it or not? I won't, but you can think about it. Four things I think effective leaders know. One, we live in a world of uncertainty. And that sounds trivial. That sounds absolutely trivial when I say that. But from an academic point of view, remember economics? Remember cerebus paribus? They explain everything as long as everything else is held constant? Well, nothing is held constant. You leave Cornell, nothing is constant. There are no perfect decisions. Decision theories, optimizing decision theory. Well, there's something out there called bounded rationality. What does it mean? We make decisions within the insular world that we make. Sure, we make rational decisions, but only given the information we have. You're all happily married. Now, what if I told you right before you got married that, in fact, your absolute best mate was a woman in northern Zimbabwe? Did you check it out? Oh, my God, I didn't check northern Zimbabwe. No one makes perfect decisions. Organizations don't make perfect decisions, and leaders know that. And leaders know that. And if you listen to the speech, it was about a man that understood that maybe I can't make a perfect decision. Leaders know that. So there's bounded rationality. So what do? We go out, we went through a whole period where we talk to everybody about planning. Planning? Most of us, like Limbaum said, and again, these are academic pieces, in a wonderful article published in the late 50s. By the way, J.D. Salinger died, speaking of the late 50s. I just heard it. Limbaum talks about muddling through. Hey! Most of us muddle through. It's the art of muddling through. I mean, you want to know what muddling through is? How many times did you lay out a plan when you were a kid to climb a tree? If you did, even the engineering school won't take you. I mean, for God's sake, I mean. How many times did you plan that? What we do essentially is muddle through. Now, knowing all of this, what do we worry about? What do leaders worry about? The gotcha game. And if ever someone said, where does the gotcha game exist? It exists within a quarter of a mile of this place. The gotcha game. What was everything on? Gotcha. Everyone's playing the gotcha game. And we live in a world of a gotcha game. Because everybody knows you've never made the perfect decision. Everyone knows you're muddling through. So now everyone can say gotcha. So in that context, by the way, in no place is the gotcha game more predominant than obviously in academia. You know, that's what it's called. The gotcha game in academia is called brown bag seminars. That's what it's called. But no place else, the gotcha game. Under these conditions, they put you together, either here or in a corporation, and they say, lead, right. You know that there are no perfect decisions. You know there's uncertainty. You know people play the gotcha game. You know the planning is close to impossible. So they say lead. That's what we tell people in Washington. That's the problems. Everyone knows this. But everybody fakes it as if it isn't the case, as if there are perfect decisions, et cetera. So what's my point? My point is that you may have aspirations, and you may have goals, and you may have visions. But if you don't mobilize campaigns and sustain momentum and understand the practical skills of doing that, you're not going to be leading. You're going to be dreaming. You're going to get elected, but you're not going to deliver. And I'm not talking, I know, everybody thinks I'm talking about, no, I'm not. In any job. In any job. Leaders are always in a campaign role. The challenge is to get them, to get people on your side, to sell your ideas, and to deliver under conditions of uncertainty. I got to get you to believe in my ideas, and then I got to make sure that once you believed in them, I can keep you and we can execute and deliver those ideas. That's what I talk about, the micro skills, the pragmatic micro skills of leadership. You know, charisma is one thing, but it isn't going the distance. Now, what does that mean to me? To me, it means two classic distinctions in social sciences. One, the ability to mobilize people, to initiate, and the political competence to get people on your side. Now, when you go to a group of people and you say to them, you know, especially in corporate world, you say, you know, you need political competence to lead. I remember someone once at Cornell told me, actually it was I won't say who. Actually, someone said to me, I'm not political. Well, you shouldn't be a dean if you're not political. I don't know if you know this, academia is political. I'm not political. The point is you need the political skills to get people on your side, and you need the managerial skill to sustain momentum. I've got to sell you my ideas, and then I've got to deliver on them. And now what we have to do is take leadership down to the laws of it and get it down to manageable, specific skills. Now, I just want to make something very important here. Moving away from charisma gives us a sense of being more democratic about leadership. Because charisma is too correlated with too many other factors. Culture. How do you speak the English language? Years ago at NYU, an art historian, when I wanted to become an art historian, a young art historian said to me, you don't speak as an art historian should. That's why I teach organizational behavior today, all right? The point is, charisma, these factors have something to do with other callings. Gender. We have to make leadership work on a skills level and begin to train people and then stop telling people either wait for a charisma injection or you don't have a leadership personality. Bobby Knight once said to a class of MBA students, leadership, I know what leadership is, but one thing I can guarantee you, none of you have it. I go in front of my class and I say, I know what leadership is, and all of you can learn it and how to do it. And I think that's important. And what do you need to do? You need to do these two things. So I'm going to run through these very quickly. First, the skills to mobilize people. Simple principles. Now, all of this obviously has all the et cetera, I can show we've done work. But let me just tell you about the skills to mobilize. How do I get people on my side, and how do I get them to mobilize my side? First principle, and that's political competence. Political competence. Never act alone. You know, if as a leader, you would simply have this sign over your bed, or better still, on your door before you leave, never act alone. It doesn't mean take everyone totally seriously. It doesn't mean process things to death. It just says at least give the sense that you're never acting alone. Successful leaders create a coalition mindset. Recently, there's been a lot of talk in management about this notion of teams. You know, somehow teams doesn't do it for me. Join my team. But when I go in there and I ask you to join my coalition to change the compensation system with the retail store, if I go in a retail store to the front line and I say to the front line, what is your name?
Tim.
Tim, we have to change the compensation. I know you're going to, it's tough on you. I need you on my side to get this done. The sense that I'm actually trying to win you over. In the long term, I can simply say, Tim, I'm doing it. Now, that really is really empowerment. That really is. I'm telling Tim that he's got some volition. I need him on my side. Real leaders understand that. That doesn't mean that real leaders are foolish. They need everyone on their side, but they understand that. They keep a coalition mindset. A coalition, the idea of a joint alliance. Now, you don't need a coalition for everything. We as a university obviously are going through a very challenging period. Our leadership is now facing with a real campaign and real challenges. What they clearly understand that what they're dealing with issues with far-reaching consequences, high perceived complexity, an impacted resource, big issues. To get big issues implemented in any organization, you really need some people on your side. Again, you don't need to think about the speech the other night, but it's a good thing if you do think about the State of the Union thing. Is it an adjustment of who I need on my side and what? Doesn't mean you need everybody on your side. But that mentality becomes good. The benefit of a coalition mindset. It diffuses risks. Look, if you and I are working on something, I'm sure I'm going to learn something. You may even. But the point is, we'll learn something. It diffuses the risk. It's establishing legitimacy. Or, all right, George, we didn't need the Polish Navy in Iraq, but that's no reason not to go to the United Nations. If you remember that whole, do we go to the United Nations, simply the idea of creating a coalition that provides legitimacy. It doesn't mean, so I may deal with my students, I want my students to legitimize also what I do. You need coalitions to provide legitimacy, not just resources. Avoids revenge and avoids sabotage. So coalitions become important. Coalitions, to me, are the key to success in organizations. Now, Cy March in their work years ago in the 50s said that, but when you hear coalitions, you go, oh my God, I don't do coalitions. You know, I think of one coalition, and I think of one case. I recently was involved in an counterinsurgency movement in these two people actually planned on how to take my BlackBerry, my computer, hide it and make me go with them to Greece for 10 days, my son and my wife. All right, now that is a coalition. That is also a coalition, you know? This is not a cabal, but that's what I'm talking about. People, and you're gonna go in there, good leaders understand that everyone is gonna make an argument for what they're going to say, against what they're going to say. Arguments to resist change. Now, we, by the way, go, oh, there are all so many arguments. No, they're not. There are only about six arguments someone can say against an idea you have. No one is going to tell you it's a stupid idea because everybody's for change. No one, it's like it's being against apple pie or whatever the equivalent of apple pie in the 21st century is. The point is, there are only about six arguments that you can make. You can say your idea is too risky. I've been in Cornell for 30 years. Nick, don't remind me, it's 34. All right, the point is, we've been here a long time, Nick and I. And you know what? Now an assistant professor comes and says, we want to change the way we do something. Now, I am a social scientist. That means I'm proactive, I'm empathetic, and I listen. But I also don't want to change everything overnight right away. We have ways that we do things already. Nick's got his cubicle. I've got my office. We don't want to change the world right now. We're looking towards our retirement, if anyone can find our 401k someplace. That said, well, we're going to come back and say, our idea is too risky. Your idea is too risky. We're for change. We're going to say the idea is only going to make things worse. We're going to say your idea won't change a thing. You don't know the issues well enough. You're doing it all wrong. You have ulterior motive. The point is, no one resists. How often have you gone into meetings and were so concerned about what you're going to say, but just didn't spend enough time thinking about what they're going to say? A good friend of ours, a well-known Cornell alum, once said to me, when he was vice president of a major corporation, he said to me, the one thing he hated to do is go to a board meeting. When he turned around, he went in with, started going down the hall with 10 people. He got in the room, he was there all alone. The whole idea is you have to anticipate what people are going to say. You've got to understand their mindset. Now, I won't go into these charts and details, but for example, traditionalists, revolutionary, in different ways, we talk about agendas. Where are people coming from? Think about it for a moment. Think, and there were ways of doing that, and again, this is a short talk, but you've got to get methodical about thinking about where people are coming from. What type of people are there? What kind of agendas do they have in mind? Where do they stand with their issues? And once you figure that out, let me go back to this. For example, is someone a revolutionary traditionalist? And then on what issue? I, for example, and I think I share this with a lot of people at Cornell, I consider myself an academic issues to be a traditionalist. I believe that we need to keep top faculty who are publishing quality journals and doing quality research. And that's what we need to do. So I, in that sense, am most likely a neoconservative academic, and I most likely share my platform again with my friend Nick over there. The point, we are traditionalists. Now, there are other issues that we may be wildly revolutionary. For example, where should we recruit? Why should we not recruit from other places, from other schools? You know, who said that Iowa State doesn't have great PhDs? We're revolutionaries on that. The point is, you have to understand people's agenda. Get away from their personality. This is not a personality test. I have to figure out whether Paul is a traditionalist on this issue, a revolutionary. What is he saying? And then this whole notion of getting into the language. But I just want to give you a flavor. Once I figure that out, I got to figure out what this administration needs to figure out. Who to convert. And who I can win over. Where are you, this is just a chart, skip it, but where are you going to spend your time? Are you going to spend it with people that think like you? Are you going to spend it in hoping that you establish your base? Are you going to spend it with people that don't think like you? At the other extreme, where I learned football, the Hail Mary pass, you know, you go down and you hope someone catches it. So I'll go all the way to the far right, and if I can bring them over, maybe I'll win. But what if they drop the ball? Nothing is worse than trying to go to the extreme and suddenly have your door slammed in your face and suddenly people go, we're not with you. So people have to think strategically about where, and there are rules, where are they going to put their resources? The other thing, all right, get them to believe in you, fine, establish your credibility, but for God's sake, tell them what's in it for them. You know, get them committed to Cornell. You know, and get them involved in Cornell. Tell them all that. But you know what? If giving a little money gets them a tax deduction, it's not so bad. Tell them also what's in it. There's two sides of the mouth on these things. So when I talk about, and then there's a whole issue of justifying your initiative. How are you going to justify your initiative? Are you going to tell people just to look at the numbers? Are you going to tell them everybody's doing it? Again, there's a wonderful literature about justifying your initiative. So what's my point here? This is the mobilization problem. This is a long way from charisma. I can, in fact, train, and you can, people in these specific skills of mobilization. Get people to think about how they're going to justify an initiative. Get people to think where other people are coming from specifically, not sort of in a sort of a gestalt type of way. Get them to be analytical. Get people to focus on these things. That's what leadership is about. And when you have strategic meetings, don't just strategize. We know what we want to, where we want to go. That takes about 20 minutes. Now, who do we need on our side to get there? And that takes a longer time. And that's politics with a small p. That's politics with a small p. And that's the political issue. Now, very quickly, and I promise I'll be off in a few seconds. It's another Cornell professor line. Sustaining momentum. Okay, I got them. They're all on my side. Bingo, this is the speech. I'm not making reference to the speech, but what happened in New Orleans? The issue is someone took the, someplace there was a sense, was, there was a sense, I'm not saying, is, are we taking the eye off the ball? Just because we're so wonderful, that's why I think this events like this one, we're so wonderful, we got people on our side, now let's sit back and relax for a while. Or just talk with the base that we have, let's relax. No, now we have to manage momentum. Not this, we've got to manage momentum. We have to really begin to understand how to manage momentum. So now you've shown your political competence, wonderful. I've shown that I'm politically smart, great. Now show me that you can also manage. This is the other thing I love. Well, he's a manager, he's not a leader. Or he's a leader, he's not a manager. It sounds schizophrenic to me. But the point is, I don't want a leader that can't manage, and I don't particularly want a manager that can't lead. You know, I understand academics, we need dichotomies. There are a lot of articles written about why anyone will read articles or what's the difference between a manager and a leader is beyond me. But there are a lot of them out there. But point in fact, we want both. Now you have to manage for momentum. What does that mean? How do you sustain momentum? So I'd like to leave you with just a couple of points of sustaining momentum. What was the issues that are going on? You know, to me, once you're trying to move something ahead, yes, you want to have some sense of control. You want to create a sense of team. You want your team to move the thing ahead. You want hierarchies, but you don't want to forget. You have hierarchies and teams at the same time. You don't want to just give them, go out there and do it. You want hierarchies and team. You want control and teams at the same time. Two, yeah, you want to discuss issues, and you want to solve problems, and you want to figure out how to move your campaign, and you want to discuss what you want to do. Enough already. At a certain point, create a problem-solving culture, but don't process things to death. Don't process things to death. You've got the right in leading, saying, enough, we've got to get something out of here, moving and getting it done. And you have to know when to do that. Next, apropos, make an adjustment. Fine, you need to, but make sure you don't overreact. Don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. These are managerial skills. When you come to me and you're making a point, and I say, oh God, that's terrible. What do I soon do? Get a heart attack on the spot and suddenly adjust and sort of move to Brazil? I don't know. But the point is, I need to make an adjustment that allows me to go the course, but not overreact. What are we debating now? Take a look at what the debate now is about. Is it going to be an overreaction, an underreaction on healthcare? Take a look what the debate is about. Should we overreact, underreact? Has he given too much control to the Congress? Maybe should have taken more control. It's about momentum. It's about, we're not simply debating management. We're debating about managing for momentum. And we're all second guessing this administration on these particular issues, not on the earlier issues. My manager, is it, there's too much autonomy in Congress? Are they talking too much about the issue? I don't know what the issue, or in fact, are they overreacting? Next, you want to give people autonomy, but you want to give them some parameters. You got to control it. Finally, you want to celebrate individuals, but the same, you want to celebrate the collective, the sense of the collective, but there are also individuals you need to recognize to keep things moving. All this is about moving things ahead. And finally, and my favorite, don't let the coalition mindset slip away. You see, we're going to come to this event, and you're going to feel uplifted by the Cornell spirit, certainly not the carpeting in this room. You'll be uplifted by the Cornell spirit, and you're going to go away. The challenge for development people, which I don't envy, is how to maintain that coalition mindset. The challenge of the administration right now is how to maintain the coalition mindset. That's what the challenge becomes. So, in a nutshell, leadership for me, especially in times of change, isn't really about charisma, all right? I'll grant you. But it's about the specific skills of mobilizing a campaign in your organization. It's about the specific skills of sustaining momentum. You know, when I talk often to organizations and group, you know, we talk about change leadership. This is a hard time for everybody. Hard time for the university, a hard time. And when we take this approach, we want to create leadership culture in an organization. We don't want to simply create leaders. The other thing about leadership, and I like to, the idea of we need to train leaders. No, we need to create a leadership culture. We need to create a leadership entrepreneurial culture where the very skills that Charlie Flager has as head of his organization, everyone else has in his organization. We need to create an entrepreneurial leadership culture in the public sector, in the private sector, at Cornell, and in my kids' high school. That's what it's all about. In leadership, it's about micro, practical, little skills. My suggestion is go to Barnes & Noble a little less. Thank you very, very much. I appreciate it. The time? Any, was I on the money time-wise? I was terrified that Charlie would go, you know, and any questions, any ex-students here of mine? Oh, really? When were you there? 80? Teaching your first year? All right. Anyway, thank you very, very much for your time and your attention. I appreciate it greatly. Thank you.
Wow, that was awesome. One more time, let's thank Sam for that great talk. What a great way to kick things off for our leadership conference. And as a reminder, the books that Sam is, I think this is from your, these are from your books, is that correct, Sam? This, what you just gave us?
Slides, here's a Cornell plug. The slides are compliments of my eCornell courses, and to show the quality of stuff that eCornell does, those are actually slides that are part of the eCornell courses. So they're part of the Cornell entrepreneurial effort, if you will.
Well, great. But if you want to get a copy of those books, get them on your side, keep them on your side. Tonight, between 6:15 and 7:15, out at the near the reception or the, I'm sorry, near the registration area, Sam will be there, able to sign, autograph, personalize, whatever you'd like, your copy of your book. And that's it for this program. You have a few minutes still. We're actually back ahead of schedule thanks to the aggressive talk. That was fantastic. Assertive, not aggressive. And we have time. So the next sessions begin. It's about 1 o'clock now. Next sessions begin at 1:30. Please stay. Enjoy the rest of your meal. Desserts are on your table. And have a great afternoon. Oh, thank you. Thank you. Are we singing?
That's customary.
So will those that are here through the Alumni Glee Club and Chorus please join me on stage? My apologies. I know it's on the program. This is not a skill set of mine, so I turn the microphone over to those that can do it. And they'll lead us in the singing of the alma mater. And you have till about 1:30 to get to your next session.
Everybody up.
Far above Cayuga's waters, with its waves of blue,
now we're done. Please enjoy the rest of the afternoon. 1:30, the next sessions begin. 1:30.